Say your name.
Yeah. My name is Michael Madison, and I am Ofsted's National Advisor for History.
Thank you. Your decision to become a history teacher originally dates right back from primary school, I understand. What influenced you at school to decide so early on your future career?
That's quite right, it did. And I suppose it was later on that I realised the influence. But I think it's one of those instances that you have people you meet who, I'm not sure the word is inspire you, but certainly they set something off, they sparked something. And it was a teacher we had who taught me, when I was at primary school, taught for English and geography and various subjects, but including history. And he just set off something in me about history. I suppose I was fascinated with him because he walked with a limp, and we discovered he'd been in the Japanese prisoner of war camp. So there was something a little bit kind of, you know, unsure about him, you know, what was there about his historical past as well. But no, it was his, the way that he just taught, and the way that he kind of got me interested and got others interested as well. But then it was something that was encouraged in a sense. My family enjoyed books and visiting places, and parents, you know, as we go through National Trust membership. So we went to visit places in East Anglia where I lived, and bought me books, because I always liked books and I still do. So the whole thing just rolled together really from there.
And then did your experience as a trainee teacher unequivocally confirm that ambition or make you question it?
I applied both. I applied to university to go and do a BA in history, and also as a kind of backup, as you did. I thought about teacher training and applied to the teacher training as well. And my intention was, yes, to teach, but to go and do a history degree and then do a PGCE. But if that didn't quite work out, go off to teacher training college at St John's in York. To cut a long story short, I miffed my A-levels results. So Durham said no, and I decided I wasn't going to go into clearing at that particular stage, and I would just accept the place that had already been offered, which I'd applied for at St John's at York. My brother had gone into teaching, and he'd gone to St Paul's at Cheltenham. So I thought, from East Anglia, I'm not going south, I'll go north. And I went to York. So that got me into teacher training. Did that confirm, or did I? At times I questioned it, but I found the trainees that I was with, in effect for 4 years, doing a cert ed and then a B.Ed. Yeah. Trainees I was with, and the history department also, were just great. And in a sense, my interest in wanting to teach, I think, was strengthened rather than anything else.
So why did you then decide to do a PhD?
That's the curious one as well, because I was set on a path to teaching, and I actually applied for a school in the Midlands. It was in my third year. Applied for school, got an interview to go, and it was one, because it was that stage, teacher training institutions were under the umbrella of an established university. We were under the Leeds University, and therefore ours were external degrees of the University of Leeds, the B.Ed. So, one of the tutors suggested, well, why don't you? You know, you've done well on your B.Ed, did well on my certificate of distinction, was doing well on the B.Ed, and at that stage it was going to be a first stroke 2-1, somewhere around there, and it ended up at 2-1. But it said, well, why don't you think about doing some sort of research? And go across and talk to them in Leeds. So I went and had a chat with, was then David Dilks, who was Professor of Modern History there. He was keen, and they talked about kind of research grants at that stage. There were such things as research grants. And I thought, well, it's now or never. It was one of those opportunities. I would be able to teach afterwards, and who knows what else it might do. And because I think of their encouragement, again, it was kind of adults I was mixing with in the history world, their encouragement, I decided I'd have a go at it, and I did, and I got an economic and social research grant, council grant, which of course is just unheard of nowadays. Anyway, so that's how it came about. But I always intended that I would teach at the end. I thought I might end up teaching university students, but it would be teaching of a sort, or I might end up going into school. But that was my ambition, to end up going into school, really.
Oh, you did go into school?
I did go into school, yes. Yeah, I did 3 years. It then took me another, 4 or 5 years to finish it off, simply because it was summer holidays, that's it. And I went into teaching then, and started teaching in 11 to 18 secondary school in Harrogate. Mm.
So during those years at St Aidan's and Harrogate, from 1979 to 1996, that's a long time, isn't it?
It was, yeah.
How did your approach to teaching history change over that time?
That's really interesting. When I saw the list of questions, it really made me think, because I'd never really sat down, you know, and thought about it. Well, what had gone on? I think, first of all, I was in a very supportive department. A head of department who said to me very early on, and it worked for me, but I don't think it was the perfect kind of leadership style. His approach was, if I don't say anything to you, you're doing all right. Which, when you're new in and you're looking for somebody to say, that's fine or not, doesn't really help you. But he was great. You could just go to him and he would do anything, but he wasn't going to kind of impose himself on me or come and watch me. We shared a classroom with a connecting door at the back, and you could hear each other's voice, and there was a little window in the door, so he could see what was going on, and he knew what was happening. But within the department, there was also another, there was a younger historian. This chap was then, he must have been in his 50s, early 50s then. And then there was another chap in the department, a younger person. And together they were really good, but they were very different. The head of department was very much of the old style, traditional sort of teaching, I suppose very much content approach. Whereas the other member of the department had picked up on some of the school's council skills based. So I saw them both, and being the sort of individual I am, I take the best of both worlds. So I suppose the way that I taught changed, in the sense that it became much more of a mixture of skills work along with content. The most important thing would be to develop the children's historical knowledge, historical understanding, and their skills in terms of chronology and use of evidence as we went through. We also changed courses every now and then. It was obviously very much a period when there was all sorts happening in there. So when we went there, one of the courses that really went well, there was what was then the JMB, GCO level. It was a modern world syllabus, and you know, children love that, and that was great. But we also did a CSE on Victorian England, a Mode 3.
That's one you wrote yourself.
That's it, one we wrote ourselves, and had it validated by other teachers. It was very much teachers validating teachers. And that was really good, because we kind of developed an assessment technique, and we developed the resources and developed the course around the children's interests, and could bring in local history into it as well, which we did obviously in terms of 19th century Harrogate and the spa town and the royal baths and coming to get the waters and things. So we developed the curriculum. Developing a teaching style, I don't know, I suppose that very much depended on the textbooks as well that were available, in that sometimes the, you know, newer ones came on the market, which actually you thought, oh, that's quite a useful idea, and kind of weld that in as well. So you use those. But also, I'd been picking up on school council work. I had attended one of their conferences for one day at Trinity in All Saints. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. But I knew there was no way that the department was going to switch wholesale to that. Costs of resources and everything. It's fascinating, actually, as a rider now going into schools, how much you see the schools council booklets as mainstream in Key Stage 3. Every school you go into, you see them. But anyway, going back to then, so during that period also, they developed the Cambridge A-Level History Project, for the period in the 90s, and that was based at Trinity North Saints. And I went to do some of the work on that, the early planning work on that, particularly around the 17th century England module. And that was good. And so I picked up all sorts of hints and tips there. But again, when it got back to it, the school wasn't going to commit its A-level provision to a brand new course because of the needs of the resource that would be required, because we were running each year perhaps three A-level groups. So there'd be quite a cost. So we've got, some changes in my teaching, in the sense that looking at historical knowledge, skills, understanding, changes in the curriculum were going on, external influences, as well as our own internal developing course, the CSE course, until of course GCSE came along.
With the Cambridge History A-level, how did you get involved in that, given that you weren't actually going to Oxford at the school?
I didn't know at the time what was going to happen. It kind of came round as might have been a flyer to every school, would you like to be involved? And I said, that was interesting, let's go find out what it's all about. I have to say, although the head of department was a traditionalist in some ways and conservative with a small c, he was also interested in new ideas. Well, go and find out. So he encouraged me to go and find out. At the back of his mind, did he know that we weren't going to offer it? I don't know. I think it was just a wait and see what comes out of this project. The fact that it developed its own rationale and its own resources and everything. And he was then becoming closer to retirement. So I think he decided, he didn't want to, he wanted an easy life for his last few years as well. Be that as it may. But by then I got involved in the examining work as well.
What courses did you teach below GCSE then? I know we've covered GCSE, CSE and O-level.
Mm.
How were they adapted to different groups of pupils?
I remember now, I don't know whether it was in the magazine Teaching History, but I remember there was a kind of great debate in those years before the national curriculum, what should we do with the third year, as it was called then. I think there might have been an article in Teaching History, what should we do? Or there was a kind of running, it would be a blog nowadays, but then it was kind of a running series of comments about, this is what we do. What do you do with those children that last year of compulsory histories, you might say, before they make choices for that? Options at what was then year 4, year 5, now year 10 and year 11. And we tended to have a run through from year 7 when they came into 11 would be kind of Romans through medieval England in year 7, then a through Tudors and Stuarts in the next year, perhaps a bit into Georgian England, and then kind of Britain, agriculture, industry, transport changes from the 18th century through to the 20th. And it was a bit of a mad dash. How did we adapt it? I think we became more and more concerned about those students in the third year, the last year, about what they were finishing with. And sometimes you wouldn't get as far as you wanted, so are we really letting these children go out in 1980-odd, having studied nothing beyond 1900 or 1914, and there's something wrong here, we need to rebalance ourselves here as to what we're doing. And so that led to kind of developments of slimming down what we did. Yes, there was coverage of the broad themes, but slimming down what we did so we could get nearer to the present day, and that was always a challenge. We also adapted things very much to meet the needs of the different pupils. I think it was very much a belief in the department, I very much believe it as well actually, that all children can access any historical topic. It's just the way you explain it to them. And yes, simplification can become simplistic, but also it can be just easier for them to understand, and you can sometimes pull back and you can just show what the big picture is. I mean, people like Sharma and Starkey are good at it in terms of their television programmes because they're appealing to a mass audience, and they can get over very complex sort of ideas in a very easy sort of way, which doesn't undervalue or devalue the seriousness and importance of the issue. So we very much believe that we could do that. And that was really part of our rationale, that we would make sure that it was in a way that those children could understand what was going on, and they could start to appreciate why it was important as well, making comparisons with the present day and making comparisons with other periods as well. So that's the way we set about it. The school also had the various debates, as many schools did at the time, about do you have sets or do you have mixed ability teaching. For a time, went for top sets, and then a top set, and then a bottom set, and then just randomly mixed the rest. But in the bottom set, the school was very keen to extract those who had real learning difficulties into a kind of small, you'd call them now a nurture group, really. And that was, we were very fortunate there, because that was taught by a special needs teacher who was a historian. So, you know, I don't think the geographers or anyone else liked it very much, but the historian was fine, because she understood what was going on, and they got a good deal out of that as well. So we adapted as we went.
What challenges faced your department when GCSE was introduced?
I think, first of all, because we were a strong department in terms of personnel and beliefs in the subject and in preparation, in planning, and strong A-level department, and with good results at O-level and at A-level and at CSE as well. There was a commitment to make this work, so that was number one. Secondly, I decided, personally, I thought, well, I don't know what's going on here, I'm going to become an examiner. And I had a department encouraging me to go. So in 1988, the first year, I became an examiner for what then was NEA, I think NEAB, which then became AQA. It was the Manchester-based one, the one that had been JMB. So I went to become an examiner, and I became an examiner on the Modern World course and also a coursework moderator. So I thought, I'm going to see exactly what's going on here. And that was some of the best insight I ever did. I think being an examiner is tremendous insight for teachers. They see it, get it right insight. Yes, you have to commit yourself to your own time, but there's a paper. So I committed myself to that, and that was very useful, because I came back and said, well, look, this is, you know, without any of the bits of the questions, this is what it's about. This is what they're looking for. And that was interesting. There'd also been quite a bit of kind of continuing professional development going on, and training of teachers as to what was coming, in a sense. But I don't think we were particularly panicky about it at all. Yes, there was a concern, we wanted to get it right, and some of the early styles of questions, which had very much a source-based approach, because we had linked in to some of the SHP work, and we developed levels of response mark schemes within the department anyway, it wasn't total anathema to us or a new world at all. And we slipped into it fairly easily, really. And with me continuing as a GCSE examiner from 88, oh, I don't know, by the way, I think it was 96 or so I gave up when I moved on to A-level. That was really useful, because that obviously gave me an insight into what was happening, which I could then feed back to the rest of the department.
When you were involved in the NEAB and the AQA examining, what sort of range of people were you working with? Were they all teachers from similar schools, or people who had different experience?
Oh, there was a range of people. The chief examiner for the Modern World paper was a head of a small school in Derbyshire. I met with, there was heads of history, there were history teachers, of all ages really, some fairly young in the profession, some had been doing it for years, some were doing it freelance, you know, kind of retired but doing a bit of examining to keep the hand in, a bit more money. So the complete range of people, a range of schools as well.
And were they happy with the GCSE, the influence of SHP over GCSE?
I don't remember anyone ever sitting down saying, you realise what's going on here, do you? I think many people appreciate it, but those people who got involved in curriculum development tended to be the ones who were receptive to the new ideas anyway, rather than those individuals who were dead against it because they didn't get involved. So you tended to meet people who were interested in what was happening anyway. And the principle of trying to reward those people, those students, for a quality of answer, however good that quality, you're trying to give them something for it, some recognition, wherever you possibly could, occasionally you couldn't at all, but where you could, was a principle, I think, which united us as a group of people, although no one ever said, you know, what's it that binds us together. But it would be that sort of an approach that we were trying to give the benefit wherever we possibly could.
Mm. So levels of response marking had sort of developed gradually in schools before it was introduced as a principle in GCSE.
Yes, it had. Yeah, there was certainly, we'd certainly been involved in developing. And now that made it, I was thinking about this, I can't quite put my finger on it and say that's when it was, but I think it would have come out of seeing some of the SHP papers, some of the work that they had done, some of the trial materials that had come out from the joint GCE-CSE trials that had gone on as well, and I'm thinking, oh, this looks quite interesting sort of work. And then you had a go at having marking it yourself, you know, creating these sort of mark schemes. It's a bit of a rumble there. Do you want to stop for a minute? Sorry.
Good.
Yeah.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Go on the next question. How did you come to get involved in A-level marking?
I always enjoyed the A-level teaching, which I'd done from my second year. First year, head of department said, no, you've got enough on your plate. No A-level. Second year, you can have some if you're good. Yeah, that was his kind of approach, really. So the second year, I started doing some A-level. His period was British, so I took the European. And I started teaching then, 18th, well really mid-17th to 19th century European history, particularly France and Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, all that wonderful period of the 18th century. And I really enjoyed it. And I'd got into the GCSE marking, and through contacts at the exam board, people said, oh, why don't you do some A-level? And I thought, no, I wasn't going to bother with that, I've got enough on my plate. And then I thought, well, okay, I'll see what it's like. And there was a course that we were running for the kind of 1 year six student. The student who'd stayed on because they hadn't got their English and maths at GCSE and wanted that, and to do something else. So we ran a GCSE course called Totalitarian Dictatorships. And we talked about Mussolini's Italy, Hitler's Germany, and Lenin and Stalin's Russia. And that was really good, but within it there was a coursework element. And they wanted people to be involved with the coursework element from exam board's point of view. And so I kind of said, well, okay, yes, I was interested in being involved in kind of moderating this sort of work, just to see the sort of standards. Again, it was to find out for my own benefit, really, the standards that they wanted and the approach. So I volunteered for that, and then that developed into one of the A-level works as well, the personal option, and I became moderator of the personal option. And when the principal moderator moved on to chair examiners, I moved up to be principal moderator. So it was really partly by accident and partly by circumstance and partly by design that I kind of ended up going into that as well. And as I moved into that, I couldn't keep the GCSE going. I think, oh, I've done enough anyway of all these papers coming and that. So I decided I would kind of release the GCSE marking and just stay with the A-level, which was good. I kept that going until 2002, but by then senior leadership commitments at my school at that particular stage were just too much in the summer term to keep that going, so I gave it up.
Had you already achieved some promotion at St Aidan's before?
Yes, I had, yeah. I'd very early on I'd moved into sixth form work, and I'd worked my way up to be head of sixth form before the head of history had left. But it was one of those schools where you get sucked in, actually, and you stay. And it's got a very good reputation for itself, both locally and nationally. And so I'd stay there, but then it reached the point where there was no further promotion in the school unless somebody left, really. And you don't wait for dead men's shoes because you're never guaranteed to get it. So that was the point to move, really, which is when I changed to the school in Bradford.
That was in 1996.
That's right, yeah.
I'm going to stick with the earlier period just for a little bit longer.
Of course.
I just wanted to ask you whether you thought GCSE had had an effect on the way A-level history is taught.
Yes, I thought that was that's a very interesting sort of question when you look back on it. I think it would have done. I don't think it would have done to start with at all, but as those students had come through to A-level through a GCSE route, you then appreciated that perhaps the way that had been taught meant that perhaps the more traditional way of teaching A-level wasn't going to be quite as suitable for them. So you adapted as you went. I don't remember sitting down saying, oh, we've got to change our ways here. It was very much a kind of, well, look, these students are arriving, I taught them at GCSE, I know what they can do, right? I need to adapt the way I deal with it. And I think you did tend to introduce some different teaching styles and different approaches such into
as,
that.
Such as?
I think there was some more of the evidence-based questions came in. Perhaps there was much more discussion going on, debates coming in, getting them to do more thinking, really, rather than just feeding them. At times, the pressure of the syllabus led you to kind of think, look, you need to know this. This is it. But essentially, I think those would be some of the main principal changes that worked through. And textbooks were starting to change as well. Very influential, I think, are the kind of the textbooks that are around and the different series that started to come in. I don't know when Access to History and those sort of series started coming through, but there were kind of topic books coming through as well as your standard textbooks, and they were extremely useful.
Do you think the national curriculum marked a major departure in history teaching? Or can it be seen as the culmination of a number of existing trends from the 1980s?
From my own perspective, I don't think it was a major change of style for us at all, in the circumstances I was in. I think it was a culmination of what had gone on. Yes, the fact that now this was going to be it established kind of subject, all subjects, and it gave children entitlement for a certain period of time, which was all well and good, and I think supported that. There were so many talks about whether it was going to be till 16 or whether it wasn't going to be till 16, and exactly what was going to happen in that last year before students chose GCSE. But I think in terms of what the national curriculum said to start with, it had very much been, it was kind of, well, we're doing a lot of that anyway. So I think it was a restatement of practice as far as we were concerned, and a confirmation in some ways of what we were doing. Certainly we didn't see it as a great change from what had happened.
Do you think the outcome was something you were really happy with, the 1991 version? Can you remember that?
I can remember back so far. I can't remember ever sitting down and saying this is the end of the world, or this is the best thing since sliced bread. I think there's always something that you would look at and think, well, you know, that doesn't seem wonderful, but we'll go with it. But there was nothing. I really have wrapped my brain on this one, and I can't think of anything in particular that, from my point of view, was something that I couldn't live with. I think because by then the department had very much become, we take the best of what's out there, what's going on. Because we weren't a department which had rejected new ideas, nor embraced them wholeheartedly and rejected everything else, it was kind of, because the National Curriculum came in as a bit of a halfway house, really, I think that's where we were as a department. So from a personal perspective, no, it wasn't a great change at all. There was, you know, we were reasonably happy with what went on. I think some aspects of the fact that we're going to be assessments in year 9 and that we're going to be these huge levels of response mark schemes seemed to become immensely unwieldy. Possibly that was certainly one feeling and one concern. It could become just too much. But essentially, no, in terms of the content or the approach, it seemed to be, you know, that's okay.
Perhaps it fitted with the previous syllabuses you used, the chronological, mainly mix of political, social, economic history, covering mainly British history.
Yeah, that would be fair to say. We used to do some work. See, the CSE course we did was really, you know, quite enlightened in some ways, because we did work on, you know, it was a British Empire approach, but we did some work on the Maoris in New Zealand, and we did some work on India and the mutiny. But we also looked at other aspects of life in India as well. So it wasn't kind of Anglo-centric completely. But yes, you're right, because it was a linear chronological approach that we've taken, and perhaps that has its advantages, then it wasn't such a break with the tradition that we'd been used to.
Mm-hmm. Were there any different challenges when you went to Bingley in 1996?
Yeah, there were, really, in the sense that it was a different type of clientele. Although it was an 11 to 18 grammar school, because it was Edward VI Foundation, it was a state comprehensive school. But it had a changing cohort, really, entry cohort, very much a mixed cohort with a longer tail in terms of the academic ability than I've been used to in Harrogate. And that's partly why I went, because I wanted a different scenario to teach in. But I'd gone there as head of sixth form and senior teacher, and that meant I did very little history teaching. But I did some year nine and some GCSE and some A-level to start with. Now the GCSE, the modern world, that was fine. The A-level, I just fell into what I was doing anyway. Some work, you know, really 17th and 18th century Europe. And then it was the personal study I was involved in there. The year nine they did, again, it was a fairly linear and chronological approach. But it was, I think they took the view, well, you're from senior leadership, so you can have the groups that create challenges for everybody else. So every year I got at least one group, and so there was a deputy who was also a historian, and we used to say, well, what have you got for this year? Oh yeah, I've got similar. And we used to end up with these groups, and okay, fair enough, that was, you know, someone's got to take them, so you get on and deal with it. But the challenge there was a very much a mixed cohort. They were the kind of the lesser academic ones, and it was a matter of making the material as interesting for them as possibly could. It was combining also with a time when, obviously, you know, 97 or so, the Labour government arrives and they start the literacy and numeracy, which leads into all the other strategies that we've had, and all kind of best practice you start to pick up on from elsewhere in terms of starters and main parts of the lessons and plenaries and everything else, and you start to weld those in. I did find myself, it was interesting, my colleague felt the same, and we were reflecting, it would be not long before he retired, and he would have retired about 2005, so it would be about 2002, 2003, something like that, reflecting that we had to spend so much longer preparing and having more activities for these types of children so they could actually manage it and they could understand what was going on. So the challenge was that I was trying to run the sixth form. It was a big sixth form, over 450 students, and have a whole school responsibilities and do this teaching. And I have to say, the teaching came third on the list, really. It shouldn't have done, but it does in those circumstances at times. Mm. But I had to spend much longer preparing, I found.
You had changed your way of teaching to a certain extent, as you were saying, starters and plenaries.
That's right, yes.
That's completely different.
Oh yeah, from where I started, yeah.
Yes. I mean, what do you think have been the benefits of that? Or have there been benefits?
I think it's a good question. I think if you start from the point of view is that the idea is to engage with as many children as possible for as long as possible, that you have them in front of you for that particular period of time, then any means of actually capturing their interest, their imagination, and then sustaining it can be very helpful. What I tend to see now sometimes, there's so many activities that the children never get time to think about the previous one before they're on to the next one. And that's serious criticism that we have. However, I was very clear that, you know, something for them to do when they arrived, just to get them thinking about it, be it short anagram or something, a little exercise, a little quiz on the board, and then into the main part, and then some kind of, well, okay, so what have we learned today? And even though it was the same sort of question every time, at least they had an opportunity towards the end of a lesson to think, well, what have I learned today? And at one stage, I even put it above the door as they went out, you know, what have you learned today? And that I think approach has been very useful and very helpful to make children reflect on what's gone on. But I do think they do need time within a lesson to actually just sit and think and discuss, well, so what? You know, why are we bothering with this? What's the importance of it? Where does it fit in? And to get them to reflect on it.
What effects have there been on teachers and pupils from the subsequent changes to the national curriculum for history, do you think? Has the slimming down of content been a gain or a loss?
That's a very difficult one. I think in some ways it's been a mixture. The approach by some teachers is, of course, is to teach everything. You've got to teach it all in the same amount of detail. But the SHP approach of kind of development and depth is something that has moved across. And of course, with a mixture of development and depth, you can then actually cover a great deal. The slimming down of content, I think, has helped teachers to be able to stop every now and then and to say, well, okay, let's go into greater depth here. This is a topic that we can talk about. You know, you've obviously interested in it. We've got a local history link here. Let's just follow this for a few lessons and deal with that and then come back to the other bit. So I think that's been really useful. The danger, of course, is that once you start to slim, heads of departments will think, well, okay, well, we'll just shave that bit off as well. And with no common core, right, and I'm not suggesting that there should be one, and who's going to decide what it's going to be, because that's a real thorny problem. But with no kind of common core, you will always get this perhaps clipping away at the edges going on. Also, you've got to bear in mind that in some schools, although history generally is very well taught and recruits are pretty good, some schools it is taught by non-specialists. And non-specialists obviously have all sorts of demands in terms of what they need to be aware of and the support from the heads of departments, and there's some evidence they don't always get that. But I think the slimming down has helped schools develop other courses rather than help schools to improve their history teaching. And I think that's a concern that I would have. And of course, that really goes right through to the present day in the curriculum relaxation that we've got.
So it's really produced an overcrowding of the curriculum, isn't it?
I think it has. When you take away government rigidity and call it flexibility, it's then replaced by a local rigidity. Schools then say, oh, well, we need to do this. Oh, well, that's right. This is what we'll do then. And they become a little bit more fixed in what they do, and you get these different patterns then starting to appear in different places. So, you know, flexibility can be a good thing, but also it can have its problems, and I'm not so sure that, you know, perhaps a line has to be drawn in the sand at some stage and say, you know, okay, there is a certain element of content, a certain element of time, and there's certain topics and themes that we do need to address with young people, and they do need to have an understanding of if they're to go out to the modern world as responsible individuals with an understanding of their past and their country. but I'm not going to say what that should be.
Well, I'll move on to something less controversial. Do you think technology in the classroom has changed the way history teachers think or behave in relation to their teaching and learning?
I think it's been very slow in terms of changing behaviour. I remember when I started, it was you had a Banda machine that you kind of produced, and you had a Gestetner, which produced copies, and then the photocopier arrived. And at the same time, you had tapes, and you had film strips, spool tape recorders, and all sorts of things, and then gradually it moved into video. I think there was certainly a tendency to show more of a video than you needed to. Instead of this 5 minute extract we're going to watch the whole, well, how long's the hour? Well, the lesson's an hour, we'll watch 50 minutes of this, and there's a bit in the middle I want you to really concentrate on. Some of that went on without a doubt. Then of course it moved into DVDs, and now of course we moved into interactive whiteboards. The story really of interactive whiteboards is they're not interactive very often. It's just like, you might as well just paint a wall, because all teachers do is put up a PowerPoint of some instructions and a few bits of information. Occasionally they click onto YouTube, or they bring up something else straight away and say, look, let's just watch this for a few minutes, and then stop it and then bring in something else. But essentially they're slow to react, I think. Does it change behaviour? And the answer is yes, it does change your teaching style, because it offers that variety, and it offers that opportunity to draw students in, to actually give them a grasp of what's going on. So, for example, a quick clip from something like the film Platoon, of what it was like to fight against the Viet Cong at night. You just need to show about 30 seconds, and the children understand immediately the issues, and they can get a lot out of it. So you don't have to show a lot, and it doesn't have to be all that dramatic, but they can actually pick up immediately the understanding. You know, was it Mao, a picture paints 1,000 words. You know, you can just show something and they immediately grasp it, and that allows you then to move on. But there has been a tradition amongst history teachers to be that the history teacher is the fountain of all knowledge, and they kind of impart from the front rather than letting the children find out for themselves. But I think that's increasingly happening, and the teaching becomes much more of a kind of prompt, facilitator, explainer, guide, all those other roles that a teacher can fulfil. The students then have an opportunity to work it out for themselves.
Are the teachers still designing the learning activity?
Yes, that still happens, yeah. It depends on the nature of the topics that you see, but yes, I take your point. The teacher can be designing it. You know, I did see one, a colleague actually saw a particular lesson where apparently it was an A-level lesson, and the teacher said, we're going to do some work on a new topic today, and there's lots of resources over there. I'm going to tell you about it, and then you're going to do some work on it, and then you're going to come back and tell the rest of us. And then he just wrote Mussolini on the board and sat down and said, there you are, that's it. What do you want to know? And now, clearly, it was a very experienced teacher with a class that was used to that sort of approach, in a sense, and were kind of self-motivated, capable individuals who could then go, okay, well, but what do we want to know about this person? And perhaps that's the way we should be moving, saying to children, well, actually, this looks quite an interesting sort of topic. Perhaps we need to know something about this Black Death. What do you think we need to know? And occasionally you do see that in lessons and turn it over to the children. You see a bit of it in primary schools now, where they're suggesting, but of course one of the dangers is that what they suggest might be important, of course, turns out to be not so important, and of course time has gone on, and time is of the essence, in a sense. So there has to be that sort of guidance to, well, actually this might be an interesting theme to follow in relation to that. But yes, I mean, the teacher still is in many ways guiding the learning or guiding the activity to kind of prompt the children, but within the constraints of an education system which devote so many hours to a subject per week, per fortnight, per month, per term, there has to be some element of guidance to make the most best use of time. So it's a balance.
It's an interesting point, that. Obviously, you've learned a lot from your career in teaching. What made you decide to join the inspectorate?
Many years ago, I'd seen one or two HMIs, and I'd met them when they'd come into school. And whenever I met anyone, I tended to say, I don't mind me asking, but what did you do to get to where you are now? And it was always interested me as to kind of what they'd done. And quite a few of the HMIs that I'd met had said, oh, I've been in teaching and became this, and then decided to move on. Oh, okay. And I'd always looked, yes, I had looked up to these people as individuals of, you know, had this fabulous sort of position that they could roam across the whole of the kind of educational world and then say, well, look, actually, this seems to be good practice and this is a real worry. That was always at the back of my mind. I'd also reached a point in my career where I was applying for headships. I'd done the National Professional Qualification for Headship and got that. And I was applying for headships and headship interviews came up, and the HMI advert came up as well. And I thought, well, I'll have a go at this. So I ran the two parallel during that year, 2006. I ran the two in parallel, and I'd got invitations to interview for a headship, and I went for one. And I remember it was on the Wednesday and the Thursday, and I knew the decision for the HMI was the following Monday, and that had been rumbling on from January to May or so. It went on and on as an application process. And I didn't get this particular headship, which, fine, okay. And then the following Monday I got the phone call to say I got into HMI. So I was absolutely delighted at that stage. So really it was a kind of combination of a kind of, perhaps not a lifetime ambition, but certainly it was there at the back of my mind as a possible route at some stage in the future.
So the HMI is part of Ofsted?
Yes. HMI have been around since 1839, when they were first appointed to look after education and to inspect on education. And by the late kind of second half of the 20th century, they were positioned within what was then the Department of Education and Science, the DES, as their curriculum advisors, in a sense, and inspectors. But then when the Tory government created Ofsted, they moved the HMI out of the department into Ofsted. But for Ofsted then to inspect all schools, as was then created as the model in the 1990s, they couldn't do it on their own. So they then brought in additional inspectors to supplement. So the inspections are run by a combination of HMI and additional inspectors. But whereas the additional inspectors are just employed on a kind of job-by-job basis, HMI is a full-time role. And so, for example, for myself, I only do something like two whole school inspections a term, because 75% of my time is devoted to history, which is fantastic.
And you say 75% of your time is devoted to history. What sort of work is related to
that? I think one of the important things, when I joined HMI to start with, you do a variety of different types of inspections of different schools and different work, but then they also have the what were then specialist subject advisors. And in this last, actually since the 1st of September, there's been an internal reorganisation within Ofsted and created kind of different directorates. And there's an inspection development, which develops the frameworks, inspection delivery, which actually goes out and checks on what's happening, and there's been this group created called Strategy, where also sits the Chief Inspector's private office. It's quite a small section, but the National Advisors, as we've now become, have been put in there, and it's kind of a raised profile of the importance of the National Advisor role within Ofsted, in that we gather a lot of information, and I'll come to that in a minute. Gather a lot of information. It's better making better use of that information in terms of improving the educational system and life chances for children. Right, so as a national advisor, 75% of my time is devoted to history. Now that involves, really, I am the knowledge person for Ofsted on that subject. So if anything happens that they want a view on it, they turn to me for, well, what's our view? And that's an opinion I would give. So, for example, when during the summer a letter came in from the Lib Dems to the Chief Inspector about teaching history at Key Stage 3, you know, I drafted the reply. And then it went back to her and she tweaked it and off it went. So that's sort of role. So, but besides that, we also have a subject inspection programme each year. Every national curriculum subject inspects year on year on year on year a sample of primary schools and a sample of secondary schools.
Separate to their Ofsted inspection?
Yes, separate to the institution inspections. The whole school inspections go on every 3 years. Well, they're moving on to a longer programme now. But they can, in between, have a survey visit, for example, like behaviour or learning outside the classroom or something, or a subject visit. So whenever I ring up a school and say I'm coming to a subject visit, you know, there's always kind of why us, why history, and you go through, well, it's random. The school has fallen in between its institution inspections. We do these surveys to see what's going on. You know, every school from Land's End to Hadrian's Wall is kind of goes into the pot, and the random sample of large schools, small schools, urban schools, rural schools, you've come out and it happens to come out on a history list. And Head's quite happy with that. They're quite happy, they say, that's fine. And we go and we judge the effectiveness of history in the school, but we also glean information as to what's going on. And then every 3 years, we write a report as to what's happening in that particular subject. So the last history one was 2007, History in the Balance, and the next one will be autumn 2010, which will pick up on that three-year cycle. And in that three-year cycle, we'll have visited well over 100 primary and secondary schools. And that's excuse me, and that gives a very clear impression of what's happening. Now, to do that, I have a team of HMIs and additional inspectors who actually go out and do those visits. We do them together. So part of my role is leading and managing that inspection team, quality assuring their letters, which go back to the school and which go onto the Ofsted website because they're made public, and dealing with any kind of issues that come up from that. I also am invited to meetings and to do presentations galore, because people want to hear what you have to say and to talk to you and perhaps bend your ear as well. So for example, today I was at the department this morning having what's called a keeping in touch meeting with my colleague from QCDA and two people from the department who deal with history, talking through the kind of current issues. And I then had a meeting afterwards with my colleague from QCDA, Jerome Freeman, I think. Yeah, that might have met Jerome. And we had a chat about what's going on from our points of view. Anyway, that can happen. The next time in London, I'm giving a talk to history teachers in Merton. I'm doing a talk in Berkshire coming up soon. There's a Midlands History Forum, want me to go and talk to them as well about what's happening. So there's constant requests like that. And it's keeping up to date with what's going on within the world of history within schools. And the national advisor role now is not quite cradled to the grave as far as Ofsted is concerned, but it very much recognises the fact that we're going from early years, the kind of knowledge and understanding of the world that children are taught there, right the way through to adult education as well. So it's a very wide brief, and I'm still coming to terms with what that means. So it's reporting, it's representing Ofsted, it's gathering the data, it's interpreting that information and voicing it every now and then as we think fit to actually inform the public debate as to what's going on. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's. I never thought that I would end up having back in history again and so much of my time within history, but it's absolutely fantastic and I thoroughly enjoy it.
The History in the Balance, you didn't...
I didn't write that, no, my predecessor wrote that.
But I wondered if you could comment on what it reflects, because there were certain concerns raised in the very title, History in the Balance, suggests that it's at a cusp, if you like. There's a point at which it's going to be a problem or there's going to be problems. And I just wondered if you would like to comment on what it was really trying to do Was it a warning to politicians?
Don't know, I think you'd have to ask the author about that, what he was trying to do on that particular one. But I think it was... Can I just stop a minute? Can I?
Yeah, okay, that's fine.
We ready?
I think History in the Balance was a very interesting report, because it was the first of the cycle of subject reports that Ofsted are now producing, the first of the history ones. And every subject has been through the first cycle, and some are now starting to go through a second cycle. As far as the history one is concerned, I think it raised various questions rather than answers to what was happening, and it raised concerns around primary teaching, and particularly around the fact that for many children they get their history teaching, the bulk of it, at Key Stage 2, in that 4-year period at Key Stage 2, particularly if they give up at the end of Key Stage 3-year Key Stage 3 history and don't do it at GCSE or beyond, and that those 4 years are taught in the main by non-specialists whose PGCE course or whose training course would have only had a few hours devoted to history, and whose continuing professional development currently is dominated by literacy and numeracy and other government strategy demands. So there was a real question mark over what's the implications of this. Are the children getting a good deal? Is their knowledge and understanding and their skills being developed as well as they might be or should be? So I think it was raising questions around the primary. Around the secondary, it was raising similar sorts of questions around the squeeze at Key Stage 3, the squeeze in time, in terms of whether children have a 2-year Key Stage 3 or 3-year Key Stage 3. Not so much around the change in the curriculum in terms of introducing a competency or theme-based curriculum in Year 7, which has developed since then, really, and it's another concern. Nor so much around time per week, because there was not a lot of data about that, although there were some concerns. But certainly concerns around Key Stage 3 and the squeeze in terms of what was happening in the 2-year Key Stage 3. And it's really putting those together, was history perhaps in the balance of remaining what Ofsted have generally said and what HMI have nearly always said, is a well-taught sort of subject where students do well. It's the most popular optional subject at GCSE. Standards remain high. It's now dipped to about just over 30% of students take history at GCSE. But actually the data shows that it dipped there about 10 years ago and it stayed fairly level since then. The dip took place in the 1990s, where it obviously fell because there's an HMI publication from the 1980s, History in the Primary and Secondary Years, a really quite an influential publication. Perhaps I should have mentioned that earlier, because I bought that as a young teacher. I've still got it. But that publication talked about 50% of children taking public examinations from the data that they had. So that's mid-80s. Well, by early 2000, it's gone down to the 30%. So the change has clearly happened somewhere in the 90s, no doubt as a result of GCSE and other courses coming onto the curriculum at that particular stage. So it was raising concerns, really, around the secondary curriculum at Key Stage 3. But perhaps it didn't go into the depth that we can now go into, in the sense that there's more data being produced, there's more detail, and perhaps the next report will have something a bit firmer to say about some of these issues. It was more, I think, raising concerns and asking questions rather than answering some of the big issues.
And who was expected to pay attention to those concerns?
Well, I think it was the recommendations were certainly aimed at the government, the department, at QCA as it then was, and at the TDA. Well, the Teacher Development Agency, really now all that does is commission teacher training according to government figures and money. The QCA, because of the way it's gone over the last few years and looked at cross-curricular work much more, would, in my view, it, it's backed off having a curriculum role as far as history is concerned. It's not voiced itself very loudly at all about individual subjects, more about kind of the importance of cross-curricular themes. And the department itself, of course, has moved towards freeing up the curriculum at Key Stage 3 and letting schools not quite do their own thing, but certainly experiment and innovate, of which I'm not against, but it's got an impact. And I think when it comes to the next year, I think, you know, we'll be able to comment much more, because we are picking up in our inspections concerns around the curriculum at Key Stage 3, more so than we've ever had. And so the data is just starting to build that there are issues there coming out. But of course, when you're in the middle of something, it's difficult to be able to actually to stand back and to work out precisely what's going on.
Looking back, how have the priorities of the school history curriculum changed over the past 30 years?
It's like an A-level question, S-level question, isn't it? Discuss. Oh, dear.
I found that one quite a taxing one to think about, really, in terms of the kind of the priorities that have changed over the last 30 years or so. I think we're much more aware now of the of what subjects children take and don't take, and therefore a priority for many people is to ensure that as many students as possible get as strong a history education as possible for as long as possible at secondary school in particular. And that's really the heart of the big issue of what happens at 14. Now, I'm not saying that we're back into the should it be continued to age 16, but of course the opposition parties have voiced various things that they might do if they ever get into power, and who knows. But we can't keep clipping away at kind of the history curriculum and not expect that to actually have an impact on students' understanding and their knowledge. It's bound to. The priorities have also changed, whereby we think nationally much more now, whereas before you thought about what was happening in your own school and perhaps your local exam board and that was it. Now there's much more interest in terms of what's happening to history elsewhere. There's far more awareness of what's gone on. I think things have changed in terms of the kind of skills versus content debate, as it was, has gone away, and it's kind of a mixture of, you know, content is important, but so are skills important as well, and it's a balancing act, really, that's important there. It's interesting, as I said before, how often you see SHP books in very mainstream and traditional type departments. You meet their department and you see the teaching, and it's very traditional. And then you look at the textbooks, and they're all using the SHP textbooks. Become very common in that sense. Yeah, good for them, because some of them are really very worthwhile publications. Change in terms of priorities. I think there is concern over curriculum developments at primary school, particularly with the latest primary review, because that is suggesting a kind of thematic approach. And the danger with themes is that you make curriculum links which are spurious, and therefore then it does nothing for coherence in terms of an understanding of that particular subject, because all you've done is linked into whatever the latest theme is. So I think that's a little bit of concern. And if we get this thematic approach at Key Stage 3 and a thematic approach at Key Stage 2, I'll start to worry about the implications of that, and we're back to where we were 30 years ago, and then it will be, you know, people think it's, well, potentially then, of course, there's all the integrated humanities approach was not a success.
So do you think history is in danger now? That's my final question.
Oh, no. Yeah. Emotive language. I noticed Historical Associations, their latest research that they've just published, talked about on the report itself, was that history was in danger of disappearing in some schools. But on their website, they talk about history is in danger of extinction, which is slightly more emotive language.
It's hard to sustain an argument about history being in danger when you look at the fact that GCSE numbers have stayed fairly static at well over 200,000 students each year for the last 10 years. And the A-level numbers are starting to pick up slightly from what they have been over the last few years. Where history, I think, is in danger is in Key Stage 3, with this squeeze on time and curriculum decisions by central government freeing up the curriculum and saying to schools, well, innovate, and schools then being driven by a desire to raise their GCSE results to look good in terms of various government tables and results analyses, and therefore looking at what is a quick fix to do that, or what they perceive to be a quick fix, rather than perhaps maintaining a balanced curriculum. And I'm being quite controversial there. So. But also, then at Key Stage 1 and 2, you've also got the concerns of the curriculum changing as well there to perhaps a more thematic approach. And then when that actually comes through, the children who are taught like that, when they reach GCSE, will they be able to cope? Will they then be able to pick up AS and A2? And the implications that that then has for universities and academic study is obviously several years down the road, but there are concerns there. So I don't think it's in danger of disappearing or anything like that, but it's in danger perhaps of not delivering as good a deal to young people as it has done and it can do.
That's a good place to finish. Thank you very much, Mike.